Green Bay's choice for news talk. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Trump campaign says obviously he was joking in Pennsylvania today when the former president said this about using the press gallery to shield him from a shooter.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reacting, telling MSNBC.
People who might thinking about voting for him have to know that he can't last as president for 4 years with his brain deteriorating at the rate that it is and is clearly evident.
Our new ABC News Ipsos poll out today showing Harris with 49% support among likely voters in this final weekend, Trump with 46%. And to Spain, where the death toll from last week's catastrophic flooding has now reached 217. The king of the country touring the area affected, he was pelted by mud by enraged survivors not happy about the federal response. This is ABC News. In Spain, survivors of last week's deadly flooding voicing their anger at government officials for their response to the disaster. ABC's Patrick Reville has more from the foreign desk.
Hundreds of angry people confronted Spain's King Felipe and Queen Letizia, throwing mud at them and shouting murderers as they visited a town badly hit by last week's catastrophic floods. The crowd in Paiporta, furious at the government's response to the disaster, the king talking to some to try to calm them. He and the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, were eventually evacuated. It shows the anger at the government over the floods that killed at least 217. Days on, some towns are still begging for help. Patrick Reville, ABC News, at the foreign desk.
British prosecutors have received evidence from police on alleged sexual offences by comedian Russell Brand. The Crown Prosecution Service now reviewing the case for potential charges. Brand, accused by multiple women, denies all allegations, claiming his relationships were consensual. Dave Packer, ABC.
Quiet down. Here she comes.
Shh. Surprise! Your accountant just emailed to say your quarterly taxes are way higher than you were expecting.
At Progressive, we know small business owners don't usually like surprises because they cost you money. But a good surprise that could save you money? Getting discounts with a commercial auto quote from Progressive.
Also, your favorite employee is leaving. They're going to pursue their dream of being a veterinarian.
Surprise yourself. See if you can save in as little as 7 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103.
Yes.
Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. One thing that's not a top headline in this election is our national park system. But conservationists want you to think about it when you fill out your ballot. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The National Parks Action Fund scorecard tallies the voting records for U.S. House members on bills about park funding, endangered species, and oil and gas development in and around parks. In Wisconsin's delegation, all six Republican House members got failing grades on the scorecard, and the two Democrats got A's. Kristen Brengel with the National Parks Action Fund says they're not trying to pick on members of Congress, but hope the scrutiny will help to change some votes moving forward.
This is just part of our value system. Do we love these places? Do we want to take care of them? Do we want to make sure they have adequate park rangers in them? And this vote is just a direct way to tell whether or not your member of Congress cares about the future of our national parks.
Overall, Brengel says more House members received Fs than As, in part because last year the House voted to cut funding for national parks by 13%. The scorecard is online at nationalparksaction.org. John Anfinson, a retired superintendent for the National Park Service, says keeping the park system in good shape should be a bipartisan priority.
For every dollar America puts into national parks, they get about $15 back. It's a money generator for America. So I think it's a positive thing to fund national parks. It brings money back instead of taking money away.
Even without a national park, the National Scenic Trails and other lands managed by the Park Service here in Wisconsin contributed more than $64 million in visitor spending last year to the state's economy and support over 900 jobs. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A soggy Sunday on the way as showers move in. Highs in the middle 50s, gusty southeast winds, up around 20 and 25. For tonight, showers, lows in the lower 50s. More shower chances on Monday, highs in the mid-60s.
Right now, it's 51.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we will look back at the weekend's news and also preview the election coming up on Tuesday, a special edition. Join us then.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this broadcast on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This is our weekend weekly wrap-up, our analysis, our review, our examination of the recent news stories in the areas of law and government, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice in America and beyond. Delighted to have you, honored to have you with me and my producer, Max, this weekend as we take on those important issues affecting our lives and our livelihoods in our state, in our nation, and on the face of this planet. As always, inviting as well your inquiries, your questions, even your commentary about the things on our ambitious but achievable agenda, our syllabus for discussion in those areas of government, law, and justice as we pursue all of those most recent news stories populating our newspapers, populating the media just this past week. Let me begin by talking with you a bit about that syllabus. Again, recognizing that it spans many, many areas geographically and also issues across the board. We're going to begin, as we did last week, talking about things not in the area of campaigns, although we're going to get back to that very shortly, the campaigns here in the United States of America. We're going to go south for a few minutes. We're going to go to Mexico and talk about some major rule of law challenges going on right now in that nation, having to do with judicial reform. Something significant happened, not only with respect to the Supreme Court in that nation, but also the response and the contemporaneous action of the legislature. They're basically attempting to shut down any challenges to recent legislative changes that would affect the judiciary. It is too much to say there is a crisis going on right now in Mexico, but there is certainly a fight, a very strong fight between the legislature and the Mexican Supreme Court about the future of justice in that nation. We know that Mexico most recently elected its first woman president in its history. That woman is now at the head of the party that is leading the reforms that have drawn the ire, the criticism of the Supreme Court. We'll talk about what exactly is going on and not going on in Mexico these days. And then, yes, we're going to be continuing our focus just days away from the election on things related to a possible future presidency by Donald Trump. We began last week by talking a lot about the ways in which a president, any president, could use, should not use, but could use the Department of Justice for political purposes. We'll talk about the limits of that. We'll remind all of us about the things that Donald Trump has said, talking about jailing his rivals. Can he do that? Are the mechanisms in place? Are the structures there inside the Department of Justice permit a president, any president, including Donald Trump, to use the trappings of the Department of Justice to jail rivals, to engage in retribution against them for perceived ills and wrongs. We'll talk about the limits on that power. We're going to be assuming, once again, a structure that talks about internal Justice Department mechanisms having to do with appointments. We'll talk about investigations and the ways in which those could and cannot be used to do what Donald Trump wants to do. And then another safeguard, which is, of course, the grand jury, judges generally. We'll talk about all of those things, asking the simple but important question, can Donald Trump do what he pretends to do if he becomes the president, which is use the Department of Justice for political retribution? The answer is no, with a small n, but also with some compromises to the Department of Justice, as we know, in the wake of that major Supreme Court case, effectively granting him, any president who may occupy the White House, almost complete immunity with respect to many things, including absolute immunity for things related to the Department of Justice. That's part two. Begun last week, continuing this week, our examination of that, and also focusing on this thing called the unitary executive theory, UET. What does that mean? Why is it being bandied about now in the present campaign? And how does it intersect with this notion of increased power inside an executive branch to be used or not used, depending upon who is elected next Tuesday? Then, of course, we're going to go to some major news in the area of voting. Lots of important things coming out of places like Pennsylvania, like Virginia, Mississippi. Lots and lots of decisions being made, not only by local and state courts, but significantly the Supreme Court. Yes, that's right. The United States Supreme Court, once again, weighing in, or actually not weighing in, on some of these issues that do have an impact upon who is voting and not voting on Tuesday. And that includes Virginia, an effort by the governor, the legislature there, to purge the voters, some voters, about 1,600 of them, from the existing polls. We'll talk about Pennsylvania, the counting of ballots, in particular what the Supreme Court did that permits the filing, the submission of provisional ballots to ensure that some of the laws there in Pennsylvania do not prohibit the franchise being extended to everyone. There's also some interesting litigation coming out of Bucks County having to do with mail-in ballots, and some things having to do in Mississippi with the same kind of thing. All of that going on in the courts just days, really even hours before the election itself is underway. Virginia, Pennsylvania, much in our news analysis this weekend on Amicus, a law review. And then necessarily, we're going to talk a little bit about what the Supreme Court is going to be doing this coming week, even as we're going to the polls and counting the election results. Supreme Court back in business this week. Additional cases. We'll tell you a little bit more about what those cases are all about. And then, of course, we know that regardless of what happens on Tuesday, regardless of what the ultimate result is, perhaps not realized, counted, fully acknowledged and embraced until later in the week, we know that there are some things going on in November in the New York Manhattan Criminal Court. Yes, that's right. Judge Juan Merchan, lest we forget, has scheduled the criminal sentencing of Donald Trump for November 26, just 3 weeks after the election itself. Donald Trump previously having been convicted by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt of 34 counts of violations of New York state law involving fraudulent submissions, fraudulent records, false documents. All of that coming to a head, according to Juan Merchan, the presiding judge. He is going to sentence a defendant named Donald John Trump based upon that conviction way back in May, almost 6 months ago. Now, finally, a sentencing coming up right before Thanksgiving. That presumably will happen, regardless of whether Donald Trump is elected our next president or not. The judge going ahead in the context of Donald Trump, defendant, not president-elect or not private citizen, that is going to happen in late November. Another milestone, a stunning milestone in the history of America. All that coming up and more this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. Delighted once again to have you joining me for our discussion, our engagement on these important pre-election issues here in the United States of America, affecting plainly Wisconsin, states beyond, and the entire world.
And speaking of that, let's begin. Let's begin by talking about our world and rule of law issues in the context of what's going on these days in Mexico. We have talked about this before. We know that the Mexican legislature has recently, with the endorsement of the new president, her name is Claudia Sheinbaum, S-H-E-I-N-B-A-U-M. Claudia Sheinbaum, a major historical figure now, not only because of what she is doing in that nation, but because she is the first woman president ever elected to the chief executive office in that country. She and her party putting together some major, major reforms when it comes to the courts in Mexico, rule of law issues implicated, raising high the focus on what's happening with judicial decision making and how judges are elected and appointed, selected in Mexico. That has drawn the ire, the attention, the disgust, the disappointment of justices of the Supreme Court who this past week have promised to resign, eight of them, in the wake of what she, the president, and the legislature are doing. Let's talk about what is happening with respect to the legislature just this past week, and then also the response in the midst of all of this by the Supreme Court. Mexico's lower house of Congress, they also have a bicameral legislature just like we do, approved some sweeping new measures just this past week that, get this, would prevent legal challenges to constitutional amendments. In other words, proposals for changing the Constitution, the legislation that is proposed would shut those down, allowing lawmakers to reshape the country's charter without any judicial review. No involvement of judges, courts, when it comes to reviews of what the legislature does to change the Constitution. The bill itself, again, pending in the Congress there, already passed by the Senate last week. This has gone through the Senate and has been passed already, drawing criticism from lots of people out there, legal scholars, some human rights experts, very concerned about all this, who are saying it would bulldoze any judicial oversight of constitutional matters and hand the ruling party is called the Morena Party, M-O-R-E-N-A, again, led by the president, seemingly some unchecked, unfettered power to pass some really significant, profound changes to the laws governing that nation. The details, of course, of the bills are still subject to review, and this is still in the Congress in Mexico. But most state legislatures are expected to approve the measure in the coming days, meaning that this is going to go forward. This is going to go forward. And the move, of course, comes at a very tense moment in Mexico, as I've already described, in which the major branches of government are basically at war with a small W, not physically war, but they are battling each other, battling toward a fundamental disagreement about who should be in charge of democracy and the republic and how that is administered between the legislature and the courts. Now, how did we get here? Again, we've talked about this in the past. We know that the fight, this present dispute between the legislature and courts and the objection to the ways in which this is being done began basically when the Moreno Party and its allies won this landslide victory this past summer. And they used that power to effect and accomplish some major judicial overhauls just last month. And the new measure appears to be a direct response to efforts to block that overhaul. In other words, legislature coming back and saying, we're going ahead with these changes. Don't mess with this. Don't challenge us in court. And the latest salvo is exactly what we're going to be talking about as Amicus Law Review continues to focus on Mexico and this fight between the Supreme Court and the legislature having to do with the rule of law and the future of justice in the Mexican nation. Stay with me for all of that.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
From the lakeshore to Lake Winnebago.
Door to Fond du Lac counties.
Northeast Wisconsin is special for many different reasons. I'm Lisa Hale.
And I'm Terry Barr. Family and fun.
Safe communities and friends. We're featuring all of it as part of New Wisco Weekend, a news magazine show just for you, and highlighting what makes the Fox Valley and Green Bay area a great place to live.
Join us.
New Wisco Weekend, Saturday mornings at 8, Sundays at 11 on WGBW and WISS and the Civic Media app.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a lot of you talking in our initial segments this weekend about what's going on in Mexico. Some significant rule of law challenges there, some disputes between the legislature and the Supreme Court. The judicial redesign that has already been accomplished by the legislature, although not without great challenge, and that's the point. The judicial redesign requires the popular election of judges across the board in Mexico, including members of the Supreme Court. And it also subjects them to, get this, something that we could learn from here in the United States of America, subjects those justices, those judges, to review by a disciplinary tribunal made up of elected officials with broad powers to investigate and even impeach judges. That's what the legislature has put in place that has caused this later skirmish, this later disagreement between the legislature and the Supreme Court. Proponents of this proposal, of course, as it's going forward, says it will help to rid the system of corruption, provide accountability, the people themselves electing the judges, including the justices of the Supreme Court, get rid of nepotism, which is, again, a huge problem in many nations, including Mexico. Critics argue that this proposal will erode judicial independence, something we talk a lot about when it comes to the rule of law, this notion that judges should be free from outside sources and outside influences when making decisions, would politicize the courts, they say, requiring judges to run for office just like other representatives are required to do. The overhaul was meant to accomplish those kinds of things, to provide more accountability inside the Mexican judiciary. More than 500 legal actions, 500 lawsuits filed in various courts in Mexico to challenge that, seeking to block the approval of this, to go back, to keep things in place as they were before. The implementation opposed by various civic groups, politicians, judges themselves, all kinds of people out there litigating about whether or not these changes in Mexico's judiciary should happen. And that is what prompts the most recent activity. Instead of responding to those rulings and those attempts inside the courts to address what's going on there, the Sheinbaum administration has opted for a much more simple route. They've simply disregarded those and have said, we're going ahead. And the newest change, again, proposed and seemingly passing in the Senate and now soon the House as well there, is simply to say that all those challenges cannot go ahead. A legislative enactment that prohibits you from going into Mexican court to challenge the very processes, the principles that have already been put in place. Now, needless to say, that is also raising an awful lot of concern, challenge, disagreement, downright opposition, objection, outrage
by an awful lot of people who say you can't shut down the courts. That's our remedy. And indeed, the other shoe that's dropping just this past week, in addition to that legislative attempt to shut down what you can do in Mexico to address these legislative changes, is that the Supreme Court has now responded. Needless to say, the Supreme Court not happy with the initial proposal to require that they run for office. They've never had to do that before, always been appointed for long terms of office. The Supreme Court now doing something dramatic, which we have not seen in this nation. We have had individual resignations, of course, of judges as they basically have retired, left the bench. We've got a number of Supreme Court justices who right now are still alive and much active in our public domain, but they have resigned. They have retired from their positions. That's not this. In a terse, a very, very confrontational series of resignation letters sent just this past week, eight of Mexico's 11 Supreme Court justices have said that they're going to step down from their posts instead of participating in this contentious election of thousands of judges in 2025, basically saying, we're not participating in this. We are opposed to it. The legislation cannot do this. We should remain in positions as we are, appointed judges and justices. And we're so angry about it that we're leaving office. Now, they haven't left office right away. They're announcing those retirements, those resignations for mid-2025. Plainly, this is, however, the latest volley in this ongoing battle over this judicial overhaul passed by the ruling party most recently. And it promises to continue to upend this system while the legislature, again, continues to pass legislation, most recently to try to stop anybody from challenging the very things that they've already put in place. The resignations follow these attacks on the courts by President Claudia Sheinbaum and other prominent members of her party who have alleged, once again, nepotism, corruption, the kinds of things that they say warrants the decision to make them elected judges as opposed to appointed judges. The redesign of the judiciary requires that all of the nation's judges be elected in 2025, subjecting them once again to discipline, to what we might call an ethics review, an ethics set of codes, some regulations there. Also the subject of a huge amount of focus here in our nation as well, and requiring them to be subjected to investigation and even impeachment if they should act in a way that's contrary to a perceived judicial integrity system. Supporters again say that corruption will be addressed by this, and opponents say that it undermines independence of the judiciary there in Mexico. The dismantling of the judiciary is not the way forward. That's the comment by the Chief Justice of the Mexican Supreme Court. She says, this resignation does not imply my agreement with the separation from the position for which I was originally appointed until December 10 of 2030. That's Chief Justice Norma Piña. She wrote that in her letter of resignation. She said, but rather this is an act of congruence and respect for the constitutional text that governs us today. She's invoking the Constitution to say she is the one and the other justices who are joining her in leaving the court, saying we're not participating in a system that's contrary to the rule of law, contrary to the Constitution, on the other side of the political aisle, if you will. The other side of the rule of law aisle are those members of the ruling party in the legislature who say, no, we have to do this. We've got to provide accountability for the judiciary. And to the extent that you think you can overrule us by a judicial intervention on that very issue of election and accountability, we're going to shut down any capacity for you to go into court and seek remedies against our action and for in favor of the very people who presumably would be deciding those cases. It is complicated. It is a lot. And while it's too much to say it's a constitutional crisis, that's something else. That's a term that's overused and bandied about with great regularity here in our country and other places. It is a crisis. And we will continue to watch here on Amicus Law Review those goings on in Mexico, reminding us that they are our republic, their republic, and the judiciary is a significant part of our system of justice, administration of rule of law, the delivery that government promises to us to provide redress of grievances in our courts. When these kinds of things happen, all of that is potentially compromised. No clear winners, no clear losers on this right now, but a continuing battle there in Mexico over the rule of law. And as the rule of law, of course, continues to be on the ballot here in America, this coming Tuesday, we'll turn back to America and talk about the prospect of using the Department of Justice to accomplish or not accomplish justice in our nation as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Trump campaign says obviously he was joking in Pennsylvania today when the former president said this about using the press gallery to shield him from a shooter.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reacting, telling MSNBC.
People who might thinking about voting for him have to know that he can't last as president for 4 years with his brain deteriorating at the rate that it is and is clearly evident.
Our new ABC News Ipsos poll out today showing Harris with 49% support among likely voters in this final weekend, Trump with 46%. And to Spain, where the death toll from last week's catastrophic flooding has now reached 217. The king of the country touring the area affected, he was pelted by mud by enraged survivors not happy about the federal response. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Badgers lose to Iowa. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, college football. Wisconsin scored first with a field goal, then never had the lead the rest of the night. The Badgers lose to the Hawkeyes, 42-10. Iowa running back Caleb Johnson could not be stopped, rushing for 135 yards and three touchdowns. Wisconsin now 5-4 for the season. They have a bye week coming up, followed by hosting the number one ranked team in the nation, Oregon. NBA, the Bucks were back home in Milwaukee and still came up short, losing to the Cavaliers, 114-113. Doc Rivers on why they've now lost five in a row.
We don't sustain the game. We haven't been able to sustain 48 minutes. I thought the Boston game, we came out, we played great, and then, you know, there was a didn't score. It's a two-point game at halftime where it easily could have been eight, and then they had that stretch. Tonight, same thing. We have these lulls where we don't score, we don't get stops, and that's what we have to try to fix through rotations maybe, through playing different guys. We just got to keep searching.
That's Bucks head coach Doc Rivers. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A soggy Sunday on the way as showers move in. Highs in the middle 50s, gusty southeast winds, up around 20 and 25. For tonight, showers, lows in the lower 50s. More shower chances on Monday, highs in the mid-60s.
Right now, it's 51.
It was the most embarrassing moment of the Senate debate. Eric Hovde didn't know what was in the farm bill.
I'm not an expert on the farm bill.
Really? One out of nine Wisconsinites work in agriculture. But billionaire California banker Eric Hovde couldn't be bothered to learn about the farm bill. Hovde even said, quote, "Why in God's green earth would I know all the details in the farm bill?" The Wisconsin Farm Bureau has endorsed Tammy Baldwin. She's the first statewide Democrat they've endorsed in over 20 years. The Farm Bureau says Tammy Baldwin has been, quote, a steadfast advocate for Wisconsin agriculture. They cite her work creating the Dairy Business Innovation Act, which is helping farmers across Wisconsin expand and hire new workers. It's a clear choice. Billionaire California banker Eric Hovde, who doesn't give a damn about farmers, or Tammy Baldwin, who's working hard for us.
I'm Tammy Baldwin, running for Senate, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Tammy Baldwin for Senate.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Professor Charles Franklin from Marquette University Law School. This is the last poll before we will go to the polls.
In the presidential race, we have it at a 1-point Harris lead, 48-47, with 5% undecided. And how those people make up their minds, who to vote for or if to vote, that's easily enough to sway this race.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
He is a comedian, a writer, and an actor, and teaches comedy. One of Wisconsin's own, Dobie Maxwell, joins me here on Nightlight. Hey, Dobe.
Pete Schwalbe, I am Chico. You're the man. Can you hear me? Is my Amish wood burning computer plugged into the?
You got Amish. Oh, you got to update, buddy. I got gas powered and it's working like a charm. So it'll change your life.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Dom Salvia.
Next time, Ben Wickler, chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, joins me. We will preview the election on Tuesday. Plus, what's the right way to deal with election stress? I got answers. Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are talking about all things law and government and justice related this weekend, as always, focusing now on the United States of America and continuing now the second portion of what we began in our last week broadcast, and that is the viability, the options available to any president to use the United States Department of Justice in a way that would accomplish retribution, movement against opposition to rivals out there. We know that Donald Trump, during the course of the campaign, continuing as late as recent days, has promised that if he becomes the president of the United States of America, he will invoke the trappings, the structures, the mechanisms of the United States Department of Justice to go after his rivals. And he has identified them. He's identified them as Hillary Clinton. He's identified them as Joe Biden. He's identified them as Kamala Harris and others who are his political enemies, as he has called them. And the question we began to address last week is, can he do that? Can he use the Department of Justice to investigate, initiate criminal or other prosecutions against people he does not like? Can he upend the basic structures that have existed in the United States of America for 240 years and use those trappings to go after the people he does not like? The question, of course, raises as significant issues about structure and mechanisms. I'm going to talk more about those right now. I'm going to go back and provide some more basic foundational understanding of this by doing a little civics here on our weekend broadcast, as we sometimes do. I'm going to talk about something called the unitary executive theory. The unitary executive theory. Here is your law school primer for the day. It's a constitutional law theory. And we'll put the word theory in quotes because it really does not have foundation that is recognized by legitimate scholars and legitimate legislators and jurists on all sides of the political aisle. But it's another one of these phrases that has been out there, frankly, for a long period of time since the Reagan administration. It's been a concept that the Reagan administration and supporters of his back then invoked, sometimes referred to as Unitarians, contending that the executive branch, in particular the president, has great authority even beyond what we've come to understand in the 21st and 20th centuries, basically bringing in and consolidating power in the White House, in the Oval Office, with respect to all sorts of agency actions and involvements. We know that a couple of things happened in the Supreme Court just this past term. We know that in that case called Loper Bright Enterprises, we've talked a lot about on this broadcast, the Supreme Court stunningly overturned about 40 years of history and said that judges, federal judges, no longer have to or should defer to the wisdom, the expertise, the insight, the background of experts, people who know what they're talking about inside of agencies. It was an attempt to say, you know what? Those agencies don't know what they're talking about, and judges do.
That's Loper Bright Enterprises changing the way in which America works, in which you are engaged with those agencies. And that is related to this concept called the unitary executive theory, because it's also an attack upon those agencies, saying that even those agencies out there, like the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the Small Business Administration, others around the cabinet table that have some independence from the president himself or herself, all of that should be drawn in and all of that should be under the unitary discretionary oversight and judgment of a president. We also know that much related to this, of course, is that major decision in United States versus Trump, establishing, contrary to what all of us have believed for hundreds of years in America, that our presidents do, in fact, have some immunities from criminal prosecution for crimes that they might commit in office. As stunning as that concept is, those two things, Loper Bright Enterprises and United States versus Trump, much related to this notion of a unitary executive theory, because like that Trump case, the unitary executive theory says that the presidency, the executive branch, all powerful, strong and needs to be muscular. And therefore, this notion that somehow there should be some independence, some separateness from the White House among other agencies, we can't be having that. And so the unitary executive theory basically says that there is an expansive interpretation under the Constitution that aims to centralize power over the government in the White House. And it invokes a couple of things in the Constitution. This is the theory. These are the predicates for this notion. The vesting clause of Article 2, perhaps most cited in favor of this kind of strong executive, says just this: the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. And the interpretation there is just this: that the executive power includes agencies, includes administrative actions. And if that is vested in a president, that means, according to this theory, that the president has control and authority and responsibility over all of those agencies, many of which, to greater and lesser degrees, are independent of the presidency. That's the vesting clause that people point to justify this unitary executive theory. There's a second portion of it, which we have also talked about at great length on this broadcast, and that is the take care clause. Part of the oath of office that the next president will take on January 20th of 2025 is to take care that the laws, the Constitution of the United States of America are faithfully executed. The president, the Constitution says, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And according to the invocation of that, that means that the president is responsible for virtually everything, responsible for oversight of these agencies, and that the president should be the one to decide how those agencies work in the faithful execution, taking care of government, taking care that the laws of our nation are faithfully executed. Those are sort of the constitutional, although in the end, unfounded bases for this thing called the unitary executive theory. Now, why am I talking all about this? Why engage in this civic lesson? A little bit of law school this weekend on Amicus, a law review. The answer is that's being articulated in the present political campaign. You may not have heard a lot about it. It's not on the advertisements. It's not in the flyers you get at home. It's not even in the folks who come and advocate at your doors for the election of one candidate or another. All of those kinds of things. Good advocacy. That's what campaigns should be about. Aggressive attempt to get your vote. In the context of that, not a lot of discussion about what does indeed sound very wonky, very, very, very academic, a unitary executive theory, but it is implicit and it is the legal side of what is being advanced as a superpower, super empowered presidency of the United States of America. And in particular, there are two groups that have advocated for that. We've talked at great length about one of them. One of them is the Heritage Foundation, and it is the publication publisher of this thing called Project 2025. We have spent a lot of time talking about various aspects of that in our previous broadcasts. There is a second group that we began to talk about last week as well that likewise embraces this unitary executive theory in Project 2025 and in a second publication called the America First Agenda. The America First Agenda by another group similar to but different from the Heritage Foundation. That group is called the America First Policy Institute. It also is one of these think tanks. It's one of these groups that is formulating what a Trump administration would look like, and it embraces directly and indirectly the unitary executive theory. It contemplates that inside what is admittedly a much slimmer version of Project 2025 in a document called the America First Agenda. Its project also contemplates a superpowered presidency. And that's why this unitary executive theory is so important to understand. And a yes, indeed, it is academic in its articulation, but it's very practical in its implementation. The vision by the America First Agenda, again, articulated by this group called the America First Policy Institute, parallel to the Heritage Foundation, parallel to Project 2025. It calls, among other things, for halting federal funding for Planned Parenthood, for mandatory ultrasounds before abortions, stopping all of that from happening, including those carried out with medication. It seeks to make concealed weapons permits reciprocal in all 50 states. In other words, due course and due observance in all states of concealed weapons permits and authorizations across the nation. It contemplates increased petroleum production at a time when clean energy and legislation passed by the Congress, endorsed by the president, and now in effect across America, is attempting to wean us off those kinds of reliances. It removes the United States from the Paris Agreement, also a lot subject to discussion in this present campaign. It imposes work requirements on Medicare recipients and establishes, get this, only two legal genders. All that is a part of this America First Agenda being advanced. And how do you accomplish all that? You embrace the unitary executive theory. You say that all of that is a part of the work of agencies. Who is responsible for those agencies? Who makes the decisions inside all of that in all kinds of areas of our lives and livelihood? The answer is a strong president. And that's why this academic civics lesson about the UET, the unitary executive theory, is most important. And it goes significantly beyond Project 2025. That is the group, the publication of this sister group called the Heritage Foundation, in one key area. It calls, consistent with the unitary executive theory, for the elimination, getting rid of nearly all civil service protections for federal workers by making them at-will employees. And that is a strategy, of course, that supporters believe will allow Mr. Trump or anybody who occupies the presidency to root out career staff members who they interpret as standing in the way of the goals and policies of the administration. Getting rid of civil service protections that have attended upon tens of thousands of civil servants, again, who come to work every day, who try to do their jobs in a thoughtful way, who progress through their days in a way that is focused upon the facts, the applications of regulations and laws to benefit you. Do they get it right all the time? Of course not. There are times when they make mistakes, and that's why you've got the courts. That's why you've got the ability to appeal their decisions. This proposal to limit civil service protections is also a part of the unitary executive theory. This notion that we can get rid of people inside the agencies who might be contrary to our particular views inside the White House, those of the president. The Institute's policy book states this. It says agencies should be free to remove employees for any non-discriminatory reason with no external appeals, turning them all into at-will employees. And again, the change would arguably allow officials to fire civil servants for almost any reason, including defying the administration, speaking out on positions like acknowledging climate change or other things, economic policy, education policy. And indeed, that is a part of the advocacy of this group called the America First Policy Institute and its manifesto now out there. And that is why this is also very important. It is implicit in much of the campaign literature, much of the campaign attack. You have seen it as an attack upon this great, dark, opaque administrative state. And perhaps that's where you've heard it the most often in the political discourse. But that's what this is all about. And the reason why it's so important to understand that is because it's not just political language. It's not just trying to indicate to you that this is our plan. There are lawyers, there are people who are studying this closely who say we've got theories that will make this happen. And indeed, Donald Trump has said the same thing. And he has said that directly and indirectly. He has embraced many of the things that have been articulated by the America First Policy Institute in its manifesto, advocating for the unitary executive theory. And in that connection, another part of accomplishing all of this, of course, is to use the Department of Justice, as I've indicated in our previous broadcast and again this weekend. Using the Department of Justice, of course, which the Supreme Court has said the president can use as he will with impunity. As we continue our discussion, we'll talk about that important question about whether unitary executive theory and all of this can be accomplished by the president in affecting the ways that the Department of Justice, your Department of Justice, works and functions. Stay with us for that.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is an important announcement for Wisconsinites who plan to vote in the November 2024 election. Leading nonpartisan economists have analyzed the economic plans of Donald Trump and concluded that he would cause inflation to rise and the economy to slow. And 16 Nobel Prize-winning economists wrote a letter warning that Donald Trump would reignite inflation with his fiscally irresponsible budgets. Donald Trump's tariff plan would act as a national sales tax, costing the average family as much as $4,000 per year. But Vice President Kamala Harris's plan would help middle-class families deal with rising costs. In her first 100 days, Kamala Harris would pass a ban on price gouging at the grocery store. And as vice president, she worked to cap the cost of many prescription drugs, including insulin, saving many families thousands of dollars per year. On the economy, the choice is clear. Vote Kamala Harris for president. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Action, www.abwt-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. We are spending our time this weekend talking about the implications articulated by the Trump administration of what Donald Trump will do if and when he becomes the president of the United States of America. Embracing not only this so-called academic theory, it really isn't academic. It's really not founded in an accurate or even tempered application of the Constitution. But there are people out there who say that it is and that it does have legs and it would be a part of the cornerstone of a Trump administration. A part of that, the implementation of all this, the consolidation of power inside a unitary presidency inside the Oval Office, getting rid of the discretion previously vested by the legislature in our agencies across the board. Part of that is also changing the way in which the president and the Department of Justice work and operate. We know from our previous discussions that the tradition in both Republican administrations and Democratic administrations, not without exceptions, especially in the previous Trump administration. Nonetheless, the tradition has been an arm's length relationship. Can a president describe and prescribe for an attorney general the broad scope of things that he or she wants the Department of Justice to do? Absolutely. And so presidents can and do campaign and say, I want my Department of Justice to focus more on antitrust issues, more on tax issues, more on environmental issues, more on civil rights issues, more on civil issues regarding all sorts of things related to the administration of civil laws in America, more on immigration, all kinds of things, law enforcement, policing issues. Those broad things can and are appropriate for a president to articulate in direction to his or her Department of Justice. And that's what good presidents have done in the past. What they haven't done is use the Department of Justice for particular prosecutions of rivals. And that is what distinguishes Donald Trump from all the other presidents, Republican and Democrat, who have gone before him. Donald Trump has said that he is going to go after his political rivals. And the question is, can he do that? Are there things inside the Department of Justice that would make it possible for him to accomplish what he is saying on the campaign trail? The preliminary answer is no, but with a small n. Can he change the department? Absolutely. Can he accomplish ultimately his goals? We'd like to think not, because there are still sufficient safeguards and guardrails out there to prevent that from happening. We'll talk about all of those. But let's talk about what the president can, in fact, do. Well, we know, of course, that the president has great authority when it comes to appointing people to the United States Department of Justice. That includes an attorney general, the second in command, the deputy attorney general. Right now, her name is Lisa Monaco. You know the attorney general. His name is Merrick Garland. There is an associate attorney general responsible for civil litigation. There are all sorts of assistant attorneys general who are responsible for all of those kinds of other areas, like tax and like environment and like civil and national security and antitrust, all kinds of things out there. And all of those are appointed by the president. And they can, in fact, be encumbered by what Donald Trump has said would be people loyal to me, people who may have the qualifications, but would also be beholden to a president. And so the president does have authority to appoint those people. Of course, that would give him access to a vast machinery inside the Department of Justice, including criminal law enforcement. And that, of course, also includes 92 United States attorneys around the nation. Under the Obama administration, I was honored by you and by the president, by Attorney General Eric Holder, to serve as the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin in that term. And it comes with the oath of office to uphold the law, to administer it apolitically, in a nonpartisan way. Those people, those U.S. attorneys, like the people at Maine Justice, those assistant attorneys general and others, could be regarded as loyalists to the president himself. Now, what is the big check? What is the big check on all that? Of course, it is that the Constitution says that those people can only be appointed upon the advice and consent of the Senate. My nomination by President Obama was subject to review by, and it was confirmed by, the Senate. And so there is that check. And depending upon who you, the American public, those of us in Wisconsin, states beyond, send to the United States Senate, a third of the Senate up for election this coming Tuesday. Depending upon who you send to the Senate, that advise and consent responsibility is going to be used seriously or not. And depending upon the majority of the Senate, it is possible that loyalists in U.S. attorney positions, in those other assistant attorney general positions at Maine Justice, could be subject to easy and quick advice and consent by a Senate that is consistent with and in concert with a president who wants to place his loyalists in those positions. The good news would be, of course, if regardless of the Senate composition, Republican or Democratic, majority controlled, if they all address this in the context in which those nominations should be, which is this person qualified? Should they be vested with this great non-political, apartisan authority? But with a Senate that is in the same party as the presidency, that process could be much easier to appoint loyalists and keep people in those positions who are loyal to the positions of the president. One of the most powerful appointees within the Justice Department is the FBI. People forget sometime that the FBI is a unit It is an agency of the Department of Justice. It's not an independent authority. The director of the FBI right now, his name is Chris Wray. He reports to the Attorney General of the United States of America, along with many other agencies like the ATF and the DEA. All sorts of other criminal investigative authorities report to the Attorney General. Now, why is that important? Well, again, the directors of the FBI serve for 10-year terms. But as president, Donald Trump could break that norm, could fire Chris Wray, as he's done before. We know that Donald Trump fired Wray's predecessor, James Comey. Remember that? In 2017, you could fire that person. And of course, the possibility of appointing there, again, subject to Senate confirmation, a loyalist to you. All of those kinds of things indicate that indeed the president does have authority, if the Congress is willing to go along with him or her one day, to appoint people in these positions who are political, who are advocating not on behalf of the American public, or at least not principally, but who are the loyalists about whom Donald Trump has commented in this election. And of course, along the way, he's also got other opportunities to do things inside the Department of Justice once those people are there, to establish policies and practices on areas like immigration, the Southwest border, things having to do with all kinds of issues in connection with the economy, even with education, with commerce, all kinds of things you may not think are inside justice issues, but that do have implications for our nation generally. As we continue, we'll talk more about what Donald Trump can and cannot do inside the Department of Justice and the guardrails that are up against him for accomplishing everything that he wants to do as amicus.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Maggie Dawn.
Next, I'm joined by former 2nd District Congressman Republican Scott Klug and former Republican Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. Your vote will help save democracy. We discuss.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
Oh no, stomach issues again?
Stomach issues?
Who are you?
Your pancreas. I could be the real reason for your diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose oily stools.
I thought it was my stomach.
People often do, but any of these symptoms could mean having a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and speak with your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,